Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today's guest is Emma Allen Verco, who's from the University of Guelph. And Emma's work is largely concerned with the microbiome. And I'm a big fan, Emma, I'll tell you that to begin with, particularly in the approach you take. So can you give us a little bit of background? Can you tell us, maybe for the uninitiated listener, what the microbiome is and then how you study it specifically?
Yeah, sure. So the microbiome is, and specifically I study the gut microbiome, but the microbiome is the collection of microbes that live on us and in us. And you can actually talk about a microbiome in terms of a pond microbiome or something. So we're specifically talking here about the human microbiome. And it's as I said, the collection of microbes, and that includes the bacteria. And that's really the fraction that most people study, although we now recognize, and we've recognized for a while, but we haven't really had the tools until recently to study them. But there are also archaea, which are kind of ancient bacteria-like organisms, as well as eukaryotes like fungi and protists, and also a large proportion of viruses that a lot of us tend to ignore, but they're all there. And so this microbiome forms a community of organisms that has a very important role in our body to help to maintain health. And it does that through a myriad of ways that we're only really just discovering now. And so in my lab, we've been studying the gut microbiome for many years, sort of before it became a sexy subject, I think. And so we've been very kind of lucky to have the capabilities to do that. And over the years, I've built up my lab to study the gut microbiome in particular, as I mentioned. And that means that we have a suite of very kind of cutting edge tools to enable us to do that, from anaerobic chambers, because these microbes are all very, very dependent on having an atmosphere to grow in that contains no oxygen, as well as what we call bioreactors or the robo-gut, which we've kind of set up to try to culture microbes in the lab in a way that they grow in the gut.
And that approach, I mean, most microbiome analysis, I don't want to overstate it, but most, I would think, is done by sequencing. People take a sample, very often a fecal sample, they sequence everything in it, and then they match those sequences back to bacteria, which you can name and which you can identify, and as you say, archaea and phages and fungi as well. But I think, and if I'm mischaracterizing it, you can tell me, your approach is more of along the lines of a motto in the lab: if you can't grow it, you can't know it. And you know,
yes,
that's kind of your approach, isn't it? Do you really want to get these bugs growing in the lab, not just identifying them at one remove by sequencing?
Yes, exactly. And I love that motto. I might steal that because I think it's a very, very important thing. So right from the get-go, I'm very lucky that I'm kind of classically trained in microbiology. And so I spent a lot of time in my formative career years learning how to grow some really quite difficult to grow organisms. Now, most microbiologists tend to cut their teeth on simple to grow organisms, I should say. They're not simple organisms, but model organisms like E. coli and Salmonella and some forms of yeast. And what we've really done is take that to the next level and say, well, the barrier to culturing these organisms shouldn't be, oh, it's just a little bit difficult. It really, it behooves us to really spend some time to understand how to grow these things. Because as you say, if you can't grow them, you can't know them. And so, yes, we, in fact, in my lab, sequencing is a big part of what we do in my lab as well. But the difference for me is that I tend to, or in my lab, we tend to combine the techniques together. So we're culturing microbes and we're also modeling them through sequencing, but we also use metabolomics and proteomics and sometimes transcriptomics as well to really look in a molecular level at what the microbes are doing. And you can't do that very easily just looking at stool, at feces, partly because feces is kind of the waste product of the gut microbiome. By the time the microbes are in the stool, they're kind of, gasping their last breath, some of them. And, there's a very nutrient depleted environment. And so really what we've tried to do is take, we use feces, and feces is a very good, I suppose, substrate for trying to get some of the microbes out. But then we were able to put the microbes back into an environment in the robo-gut where they can thrive in a way that they would in the gut itself. And then all sorts of magic happens, because then you can kind of see them all behaving in a very different way to how they might behave on their own on a petri dish, as we tend to grow microbes in a classical sense.
Emma, do you worry about scientists losing the ability to culture? And I know that you're really great at trying to combine the more modern molecular methods with the culture techniques, but I wonder what your thoughts are as a very senior scientist that is still very skilled at the more old-fashioned methods.
And still doing culture, yeah. I do actually worry about it. In fact, so many students come into my lab who have really no experience of culture beyond E. coli. And they start, which we train them in a very kind of set way to start working with these really quite sometimes difficult microbes. And you can see the light bulb go on, all of these microbes just grow in completely different ways. And so, yes, I do worry. But I think part of the problem is that the sequencing kind of technology came in at a really good time. It's a really opportune time. It's a really important technology, but everyone just sort of like jumped on that bandwagon and decided that culture wasn't important anymore, which was a very short-sighted view. But I think it was reflective of the fact that culture at that time was very kind of difficult to do when you're talking about the kind of anaerobic organisms we're working with. A lot of the equipment that we used to use in those days is kind of old-fashioned, difficult. You had a lot of vacuum pumps and a lot of dials and gauges and things. These days it's way easier. We're lucky with technology, but it's very expensive. And so there are some prohibitive things for the sort of average lab to be able to culture some of these really difficult organisms. But it's not impossible. And I think that's what's got to come through. And I have to credit Sid Feingold, actually. He was a mentor of mine, amazing guy. He was the one that really, reminded me how important culture was, and that what I was doing was the right thing. And, I miss him. I miss him madly. I think he was great for that. But that was his philosophy as well. And so, he had a whole library of strains that he isolated over the 60s, 70s, 80s, and all through very, very difficult techniques. And I think if he could do it, then I could do it. And that's
yeah, I think he's a really unsung hero of this whole area. And do you believe, though, that every microbe in the gut is culturable? Or do you think that some of them, maybe they're, participants in elaborate food webs where none of them can grow by themselves, but they can only grow in communities of two or three or even more microbes? Have you any evidence in your culturing and sequencing work to support that idea?
Yeah. So first of all, I would challenge you on what you mean by culturable. So everything that is alive has to be culturable, otherwise it wouldn't be alive. I think what it comes down to is matching the techniques in the lab to what's happening in nature. And so you're quite right. There are some microbes that are absolutely dependent on their partner species within an ecosystem, or they're extremely specialist organisms that require some really key substrates that we don't understand what they are yet. And perhaps those are the sorts of things that come from a food web. And so we need to really understand that. And in fact, the approach that my lab is taking at the moment is really to use the sequencing analysis, the metagenomics in this case, to actually look at some whole genomes within an ecosystem, build what we call metagenome-associated genomes, and make predictions based on that for what sorts of substrates microbes might be able to use. And in that way, we've been able to pull out some microbes which are, otherwise considered to be quote-unquote unculturable or as yet uncultured. But it really just comes down to finding what the specialist needs are for a given organism and then providing them. And oftentimes that's not on a petri dish, growing. Even if you give them the right environment, sometimes they really do require a partner organism, or sometimes they might require not to be on a solid substrate and they need to be in a broth or something like that. So finicky, microbes are finicky, but I don't think we should discount them just because they're kind of difficult to grow. I think actually the most interesting organisms that we've ever worked in the lab are the ones that we have spent, you know, many months trying to get hold of. And there are still some that we're chasing after right now from some samples that we brought back from the Amazon that are just, we know they're there and we know they're alive because we can culture them in whole ecosystems in the robo-gut system, but we haven't been able to isolate them yet. But we're still working on that.
Can you talk, Emma, a little bit to educate our listeners about the differences between the ancestral and the industrial gut microbiome and why the industrial gut microbiome is declining?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So there's a general sort of feeling right now, and this is not my work. This is really a theory that was born from Marty Blaser and Stan Falco back in 2009, I think it was. They wrote about something called the missing microbiome, or missing microbes, as Marty's talked about. And in fact, Marty's written a book about this and for the lay public, so it's actually quite accessible research. It's very compelling. And the idea is that the human microbiome, and in particular, we tend to focus on the gut microbiome just because we know more about that, but it really applies to the whole microbiome, that this human microbiome has been eroded in ways that we've really not recognized because this has happened over a short period of time, but perhaps, you know, over a time when we weren't really paying attention to microbes very much. And as a result of that, in the industrial world, where we're exposed to a lot of lifestyle changes, most of them for the better, things like sanitation and things like that, you know, they can't argue that they haven't helped us live longer lives, but they have actually had some collateral sort of damage, if you like, to the microbiome, and that we have been losing microbes that have gone extinct from our bodies without even realizing it. And the idea of the missing microbiome hypothesis is that this has been happening over generations. And if you think about microbes and the way that they have evolved with us, that's happened over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And so in a very short space of time, we've changed the way that we live. And that is not supportive of certain microbes in the gut, let's say, that we're now losing at a rate that we don't really understand. It's kind of theoretical, but a lot of people have been studying it since. And so this idea that we're losing microbes kind of comes together with the realization that we've also been seeing enormous rises in the incidences of chronic diseases. And so there's this kind of idea, you put two and two together, there's these associations. And in many cases, we're seeing that a lack of diversity in the gut microbiome in particular can actually be associated with a bunch of diseases like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, many of these things that plague us in industrial societies. And so the idea here is that we've lost in microbes that might be playing a role in protecting us from those diseases. And so there's some evidence that supports this hypothesis. And that's kind of what I'm chasing as part of my Canada research chair, which is if these microbes are missing, and we can't go back in time, you know, to the time before we used to take a lot of antibiotics or the time before we used to process our food. But what we can do is we can go and look at societies who haven't had a lot of exposure to these things. And there's been a lot of work done on the Hadza tribes people in Tanzania, for example. In my lab, we're very interested in a group of individuals who live in the Amazon jungle, sort of straddling the border between Brazil and Venezuela, the Yanomami. And when you look at their gut microbiomes, what you see is an incredible amount of diversity. In fact, they have the most diversity in their gut microbiomes that we've seen so far. And what you also find is that the microbes that have been called vanish microbes or volatile and not associated, I can't remember what the acronym is now, but basically they you don't find them in the industrialized world. These microbes, that the fascinating thing about them is that you find them in pockets of the world that are quite geographically far distributed. So the members of the Hadza tribes people share microbiome elements in terms of certain species with these Yanomami people in South America. You know, that's thousands of miles apart. And so the idea here is that perhaps this is difference between the microbiomes of these non-industrialized societies and industrialized societies is more about a loss of microbes than it is a gain necessarily that that the Hadza tribes people and the Yanomami people have had. It's more about a change in our ancestral microbiome that's been brought about by industrial times and industrial things.
Now, obviously, in the last decades or even short centuries, you know, we haven't evolved as humans to the extent that our gut physiology has changed dramatically, or that we're, you know, we're changing our gut environment. So the environment must still be pretty much the same as it has been for tens of thousands of years. So what has changed, presumably, are things like you've spoken about, hygiene and exposure and diet, of course.
Yeah.
So do you think that if a modern human was exposed to these organisms that the Yamamotos and the Hadza have, that we would essentially be colonized with them, that we're still receptive to them? Or do you think our diet and our hygiene would drive them back out? If you understand the question I'm asking, is it just
yes,
we're never exposed to them, or we're, and therefore we can't select them, or for some reason we're not selecting for them anymore? Which do you think is the...
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I would say that we are never exposed to them in the industrialized world. They have just gone extinct. And so you're never going to be exposed to them. If you're living in the industrialized world, there's no one around you from where you can get those microbes. You know, you tend, that comes back to the question of where do your microbes actually come from? And that's a sort of a, we know that a lot of microbes are shared, you know, vertically from parent to child or from the environment in which they're raised. But if a microbe has gone extinct from that environment, you're never going to see it. I also think that it's not as easy as just saying, okay, well, let's just take some of these microbes and let's just give them back to people in the industrialized world. Because the microbes that have gone missing, these missing microbes or vanished microbes, whatever we want to call them, are extreme specialists. And so they really require particular substrates or particular environmental conditions in order to thrive. And we don't provide those, you know. So I'm often asked, well, why don't we just, you know, rewild the microbiome? Why don't we just take some of the microbiome from the Hadza people or the Yanomami? And even if that was ethically possible, that's a lot of red tape. I think it would be a bit of a mess because we don't eat a Yanomami diet and we don't have a lifestyle that's anywhere remotely like a Yanomami individual. One of the things that's really interesting me at the moment that I'm pondering about is this idea of diet as well. We tended to think in the past that, you know, if you eat a diverse diet, then you can support a diverse microbiome. But I'm actually kind of revising that view a little bit because looking at what the Yanomami actually eat, they live in a wonderful part of the world, a very biodiverse part of the world, but their diet is quite restricted. If you compare it to that of the person in the Western world, who can go to the supermarket anytime they want or go to a restaurant and pick from any variety of food. And so perhaps we've kind of, you know, starved these microbes out of our system by just not providing the substrates that are required often enough for them to be able to survive. And a lot of these vanished microbes, we've been able to isolate some of them from the Yanomami people, and we're looking at their genomes and we're looking at their behaviors. And oftentimes they carry a lot of very specialized, what we call K-zymes or carbohydrate active enzymes that allow them to break down quite specialist substrate.
How do we know they're better? And maybe, you know, someone with that microbiome trying to live in modern society would experience massive problems. You know, maybe our microbiome, albeit less diverse, is entirely appropriate for the lifestyles we lead.
I would totally agree with you. And there's a very good example there because as well as microbes, which are vanished microbes, which we only see in the Hadza and we only see in the Yanomami people, there are also what we call blossom microbes, which have been selected for in the industrial world. And one of those microbes is actually Bifidobacterium. And I know that ISAP people will know very well what Bifidobacterium is. We don't see Bifidobacterium in the Yanomami people beyond infancy. Or very rarely do we see it. And if it's there, it's usually just one species. Compare that to the typical person who's living in an industrial society. If they're healthy, then you can usually pull out some bifidobacteria. What's really interesting about the Yanomami culture, for example, is that the Yanomami do not drink milk. They actually find that extremely distasteful. So milk is for infants and it comes from their mother's breast and that's it. And then they're weaned and then that's it. They never see milk anymore. And they're horrified by the idea of drinking milk from animals, you know. And so I, you know, part of that is I wonder, with industrialization, we have started to drink milk. We, you know, dairy products are a thing, and we farm animals for their milk. And so perhaps part of what we have in the industrial microbiome is really an adaptation to an industrial lifestyle. So I don't like to say that the industrial microbiome is bad, because I don't think it is. I think it is in transition, for sure. And I think it is trying to cope with whatever the industrial world is throwing at it. And perhaps it hasn't quite got there. I really think that it's important that we try to understand instead, what are the characteristics that the Yanomami microbiome has that, if they went missing, could actually impact health? And then specifically try to sort of focus on those microbes as potentially health promoting.
One of the things, Emma, I thought about was that you had pointed out that if you were to restore one of these ancestral, highly specialized species, it may not thrive. There's also the worry that it may thrive all too well because it doesn't have any of the competitors that yes. it had to fend against before. So
Yeah. Well, I would say there that we have the RoboGut model. And yes. a fabulous thing about the RoboGut model is that we can do things to ecosystems, to gut ecosystems, without hurting people, and actually try to understand how these gut microbial organisms work. And so one of the experiments that we're doing, or kind of groups of experiments we're doing, is trying to take these Yanomami ecosystems and to stress them with a Western style diet, if you like, you know, a pretty poor diet, and see what happens. And then vice versa, we take a Western microbiome, and then we are an industrialized microbiome, and then we add a diet which is made up really just of foods that have, or substrates that have come from a Yanomami diet, and then we try to see what happens there. And so you can do quite a bit without actually, you know, and make these kinds of predictions to try to understand what these microbes do. But going back to something that Colin said earlier, it's not really, you can't look at these vanished microbes in isolation, because a lot of them work together in concert. So just putting one microbe in or another microbe, and they're going to very, very quickly get out competed. So when we're doing these ecosystem challenges, we have to work with whole ecosystems, if you like, and try to understand, you know, with a whole sort of clade of organisms that are a guild, what we call a guild of organisms that works on a particular in a particular area. We have to kind of create a niche for it within an ecosystem to see how it's going to behave. And that's not trivial to do. But those are the kinds of experiments we need to do, rather than just chucking in a few microbes and hoping that they'll kind of hang around. We actually have to think about making them hang around and then being able to see how they behave.
Emma, can you also talk about, you know, some therapies involve just the fecal transplant and just hoping to restore the gut microbiota that way, and that doesn't always necessarily work. I'd be interested in your thoughts about that. And also, can you tell us a little bit about therapeutic ecosystems, which you're pioneering?
Yeah, sure. So fecal transplants are, I think, have a lot of promise, and they have kind of steered us in the right direction. But they've mostly been used successfully to treat problems, you know, problematic Clostridioides difficile infections. So these nasty kind of diarrheal infections with a diarrheal pathogen that is really a horrible thing to have, and a very, very difficult thing to get rid of. And the reason that it's there in the first place is because there's been a massive depletion of the rest of the microbiome, usually through antibiotics use. And so the idea here is we're just putting the microbes back to kind of just prevent the pathogen from expanding enough to cause a problem. And usually it works pretty well. I think the problem that I have with fecal transplants is that it's become a bit of an industry where fecal transplants are kind of being given for everything. And I do worry about that a little bit from a clinical perspective. Usually the stool has to come from, you know, a donor. And so that poor donor is going to have to be screened a lot. They're going to have to be careful about what sort of pathogens they might carry or what sort of allergens they might be eating. So it's not an unlimited supply. And what happens if they get sick, you know, then that becomes a problem. I also just really worry that because it's such an easy thing to do, easy in quotes, you know, it's the sort of thing that people are doing without any medical kind of supervision. And that's a problem. But when it works, it works. I think what we've tried to do is to create clean ecosystems, if you like, of very defined microbes, so that we can, we call it microbial ecosystem therapeutics, So we'll take a fecal transplant and we'll isolate the microbes from it that we think might be important in providing benefit, clean them up, sequence them, make sure that they are what we think they are, make sure they don't carry anything pathogenic or known pathogenic, and then put them together in a sort of a super probiotic, if you like, although we're not allowed to call it that. We have to call it a live microbial product. And then that can also be made as an oral supplement. So usually fecal transplants are done up through the other way, which, you know, most patients don't enjoy very much. What we've tried to do is to just take these cleaned up organisms and put them in capsules, a little bit like a probiotic. So that's what that is.
Now, but do you think the other area, obviously, that ISAP is very interested is prebiotics. And do you think prebiotics are newly developed prebiotics might be a way of essentially selecting for some of these missing microbes, reintroducing them, recolonizing people?
Yeah, but I worry about prebiotics because it's just a little bit of an inexact science right now. What I think we need to do is to find the, use prebiotic substrates that are very supportive towards certain microbes, but to really understand why. So many of the prebiotics that are used right now is sort of like a fairly wide or broad food source for a number of microbes. And usually those microbes are beneficial. We're trying to get fermentation to happen. Fermentation of sugars is usually a beneficial process in the body. But it is not as clear cut as that, because there are lots of microbes that are pathogenic that can also use these substrates. So we have to just be a little bit more selective. So I do think prebiotics are a good idea. I think they could be better. They could be more kind of targeted. They could be more precise. But I think that's coming. So we'll see in the next few years whether or not someone rises to that challenge.
Emma, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, and we could go on for another half an hour easily, but I think we're at the end of our time. So thank you once again. Your insights have been wonderful, and we've really enjoyed listening to you. So thank you.
You're really fascinating research. Thank you so much, Emma.
Thank you for having me.